calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, we have this amazing juxtaposition here, an absolutely amazing juxtaposition between a story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about the political process and money going to the Republican Party and the story that I've been sharing with you over the last few days from Barron's on the one hand, and a piece of news coming out of Germany about the United States on the other. And I want to share the both with you this morning and point out how this, what this all means for all of us, because this affects the lives of every single American. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, also, greetings to our newest affiliate, WRVC, AM 930 in Huntington, West Virginia. Pleased to have you with us. And very glad to have you broadcasting our show. And greetings to everybody there. Our telephone number for this program, if you'd like to call into the show today at any time, is 866-440-8466. 866-440-THOM, actually, is what it comes out to, 866-440-8466. And if you want to drop into our live chat room and participate with folks in real time who are listening to the program and having some of the most fascinating conversations on the entire Internet, go to TomHartman.com and click Live Chat. Participate in our message boards. Go to TomHartman.com. It's all up at the top. Just click, you know, to get to the message boards and all that kind of stuff. So, to the issues. You may have noticed, by the way, that I'm not doing the daily horse race. I'm not doing the, well, Tester is up. Well, Lieberman is down. Well, it's not that the daily horse race isn't interesting. But, frankly, I was never a sports guy. You know, it's kind of cool that the Detroit Tigers are going to the World Series, because when I was growing up, as a kid, I was a Tigers fan, and then I left Michigan in 1978 and basically just stopped following sports. And I've never seen politics as sports. I think this is one of the big harms, frankly, that is done to the American body politic, particularly by commentators, is to see politics as sport, is to take the point of view, I guess in its extreme, you see this with people like Sean Hannity, for example. I mean, it doesn't matter what the morality of the issue is. It doesn't matter what the ideology of the issue is. He will support the Bush administration increasing the size of government. He'll support the Bush administration bloating the budget. And at the same time, talk about being, well, we're in favor of a small government and a balanced budget. Yeah, come on. It's all about, you know, supporting the Republican Party. And frankly, on my side, there are some folks who are all about supporting the Democratic Party, which I do. I support the Democratic Party. I think that they're the last hope that we have right now, frankly, at the national level. I also support the Green Party. I think the Green Party is doing marvelous work all across the United States. I support independence in general. But I think that, you know, we need to infiltrate and take back the Democratic Party. But, and at a certain level, there is an element of sports to elections, particularly as we come down to the wire here. We're, you know, less than 2 weeks out from Election Day. And in some states, a lot of states actually now, people are early voting here in Oregon. We vote by mail. We got our ballots a couple days ago. I'm going to vote as soon as I have an opportunity to sit down with the thing. It's just been super busy here. Probably do it this weekend, I'll vote. But the point is that I'm not handicapping races and I'm not getting into that a whole bunch on the show because I think there's a larger view here, a more important, a wider view that we all need to be taking. And that is, what's best for this republic? What's best for the United States of America? What's best for democracy in a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic? What are the choices and decisions that have been made in the broad political spectrum, in the broad political sense, over the last few years by our politicians and that are being pushed for or opposed in some cases by lobbyists and special interests? How can we make this nation work? Frankly, those are the issues. I mean, that's the bottom line. Yes, I want to see the Democrats take the House and the Senate, by all means. And I encourage people to get out there and find good candidates that they can support and send them $25 and show up at the local Democratic Party and offer to at your county party office and offer to, you know, walk the streets for them. And also to get involved, to contact your local Secretary of State's office or your State Secretary of State's office or your local County Elections Bureau's office and volunteer to be a poll worker. The last generation that aggressively volunteered to be poll workers was that of my parents, people now in their 70s and 80s. And a lot of us just never knew that it was an option or that it was needed. It wasn't that sense of a civic need or you know, people were working too many hours. So, you know, get involved in the process. And at the same time, and of course, you know, we'll keep you up to date on what's going on. But the fact of the matter is, from day to day, the races change. From day to day, you know, things are going up and down. And it's you know, fairly easy to basically, you know, handicap this stuff. To check it out, to see what's going on. If you go over to electoral-vote.com, they've got probably the best summary. Right now, their projection, the new Senate, 49 Democrats, 51 Republicans, and Joe Lieberman. So, you know, they're predicting right now that the Republicans are basically, if Lieberman caucuses with the Republicans, which is what, frankly, I'm expecting he'll do, even though he's not saying, you know, he's saying that he's going to caucus with the Democrats. I don't, you know. We'll see. But, you know, Rove and Bush, they say they're going to pull this thing out of the hat at the last minute. I take them at their word. It's not, you know, this race is an important one, and it's important that you get out there and vote. It's important that we all participate, and it's important that we do as much as we can. And even more important is that we get involved at the grassroots and that we wake people up, that we not just win the water cooler wars, but that we go beyond it being a war, that we bring in allies. Last night, I introduced Al Gore to a group of about 5,000 people here in Portland, and he did his slideshow presentation, and then afterwards, I moderated a Q&A session that ran about 45 minutes with him. And one of the points that the 43rd president of the United States made so well when somebody asked him if he was going to run for office again was that, you know, he was basically saying no. I mean, you know, that he wasn't going to run for president again. And I was standing 2 feet from him as he was saying it and watching very carefully his body language and his facial expressions and everything. And he didn't say no. He said, I've been in this business long enough to never say never, but it's very much not my intention, or words to that effect. But the point that he did make, and I don't remember his exact words, so these will have to be, you know, my words, my interpretation of what he said, is that global warming and other crises that are facing us, the death of the middle class in America, global warming, there's a whole bunch of, you know, his particular thing is basically, will the planet be inhabitable as we go down the road? Is such a big issue. And in fact, he quoted T.S. Eliot from one of my favorite poems, The Hollow Men. Between the intent and the action falls the shadow. He said the amount of political will, the political step that is necessary to tackle global warming here in the United States, and it can be done, A, fairly simply, and it can be done, B, in a way that it will actually stimulate and grow the economy of the United States. But the amount of political will, the kind of legislation that it would take to do it, there is nothing and nobody out there who is even close. There is this chasm, this huge gap between what politicians who are knowledgeable about this are willing or able to say and do on the one hand, and what actually is the bare minimum that needs to be done on the other hand. In other words, even the most radical environmentalist politician is not going to, so far, has not been successful in proposing legislation that will do the most modest of the changes that we need to make. And his point was, it's not about electing more aggressive politicians in the area of climate change. It's about waking up more people, because if you can wake up the people, the politicians will come. If you create the parade, the politicians will claim it. And so he's going out and he's training 1,000 people to do what he's doing with his slideshow presentation. And he's sending them all over the world. And he's trying to wake up hundreds of millions of people around the world and thus wake up the politicians. And that's what, in my opinion, we have to be doing. So when we come back from this break, I'm going to get back to these two issues that I wanted to talk to you about the death of the American middle class and the corruption of the political process on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. That is apropos to this whole thing, how it all works and how we bring it together and how we can take back America. 16 minutes past the hour.
Rubber stamp.
Have you had enough?
The wire tap.
If you've had enough, then it's time to throw the rascals out.
You know we've let them take the test too long. They got all the answers wrong. No plan, no shade, no oversight.
Now's the time to put it right.
Yes, indeed. Have you had enough? Time to throw the bums out. Back with you, Tom Hartman here. Listener-supported radio. Supported, that is, by our listeners supporting our sponsors, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. Their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532. Mention the word fall or mention this program. You get a 15% discount. Their fall sale. Or you can go to their website, sacredgroundscoffee.com. All fair trade, all organic, and some incredible, incredible coffees there that you've probably never experienced before. Particularly their Ugandan coffee. Just some amazing stuff. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532. And thank you for supporting our sponsors. Helen Thomas is with us. Helen Thomas, we're gonna get to the, by the way, I promised you this story from Germany and from the Wall Street Journal, and we are going to get to these things in just a moment. But Helen Thomas, it is such an honor to have an opportunity to speak with one of my heroes. And thank you for joining us here, Helen Thomas.
Thank you.
Helen Thomas, the noted news service reporter, Hearst newspaper columnist, member of the White House press corps, served for 57 years as a correspondent and White House bureau chief for UPI. I'm curious about the difference between the current administration and the relationship with the press and all the other ones that you've covered all the way back to, who was the first president you covered?
Kennedy.
All the way back to Kennedy.
Right.
What do you perceive, Helen Thomas, as the major difference between what's going on now with the press and the relationship with the president and the office of the presidency and
No president has ever liked the press. I mean, they think they're president and they think they should not be questioned. And our role is to try to find out what's going on. But I can say this, that this is the most secretive administration I've ever covered, and of course enabled by tremendous security now, so we really have a lot of distance between us. And I think that when the president comes into a press conference with a set number of names that he will call on and so forth, it's no longer a free-for-all. I think that his news conference today confirmed the fact that we're going to kill a lot more innocent people on both sides.
I want to get to that. By the way, I also want to mention your new book, Watchdogs of Democracy, The Waning Washington Press Corps and How It Has Failed the Public. That's Helen's book, and it's a good, solid read of really some rather startling and frankly saddening stories of what was and what is.
I wrote in outrage because I really feel that the press had let the country down in the run-up to the war. They could have asked more questions, could have demanded more evidence.
Mm-hmm. You said as a result of the press conference you attended this morning with the president that you think more people are going to die. Explain that, please.
Well, he made it clear that the war will go on, that he's become almost, he calls the shots, he talks about Iraq being a sovereign nation, which is baloney. Mm-hmm. No nation is sovereign when it's occupied. We're calling the shots, and he's saying we're staying there. And he broadened it into an ideological war and a war over oil.
Yeah. We have four American oil companies now apparently pumping oil out of Iraq, and the Iraqi people are not happy about this.
Well, the point is, who would be happy with an invader? It's their country. And then he talked about killing innocent people, that they kill innocent. What does he think our bombs do?
Yeah, this study that just came out that was published in The Lancet, 650,000 Iraqi civilians, innocent civilians killed.
And more and more will every day. And every day. People will die for their country. People will fight for their country. And the president should know that.
Yeah. I'm assuming that if Canada or Mexico invaded the United States, you'd be out there defending this country?
Absolutely. There are wars to be fought, no question about it, when you're attacked. But we don't attack, I hope. But we do, though.
Yeah, well, we never have in the past, and all's the more the tragedy. Helen Thomas, we have to go here at the bottom of the hour, but I just wanted to thank you so much for the extraordinary work that you have done and for continuing to speak out. You are a shining light in the press corps.
I haven't done anything, and I want more reporters to speak up and ask the important questions. The American people, I know, definitely want them to.
Yeah, and what's it going to take? What's it going to take? Do we need to be contacting the networks and saying, "Wake up, guys"?
What's it going to take also for Congress? More guts.
Yeah, and that's going to have to come from the people as well.
That's right.
We the people need to wake up.
Well, they
speak
got a
up.
Chance on November 7th.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, that is National Throw the Bums Out Day. It's November 7th. We do have term limits. It's called elections. And it's such an important thing. Helen Thomas, her book, Watchdogs of Democracy, The Waning Washington Press Corps and How It Has Failed the Public. Helen Thomas, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for the plug. Thank you.
Great speaking with you. Good. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back in just a moment here, right after the news at the bottom of the hour. What's going on with politics in America and the middle class? What do the Germans have to say about it? What does the Wall Street Journal have to say about it? And why does that matter? I'll tell you all about it right after this.
Yes, it's true, he's been lying to you. You were bound to find out someday. He will do what he thinks he must do. He's a spoiled boy, it's getting his way. And in the anger that's sure to come, you may even hate the place he comes from. Please don't blame it all on Texas for his low-down ways. Though his dirty deal and wrecks us, please don't blame it all on.
The folks in Texas want you to know that George W. was actually born in Connecticut and was raised in Massachusetts at his prep school in Andover and went to college at Yale and Harvard up, you know, all the spent most of his life in the Northeast. His parents' house was up in Kennebunkport, and he really only bought that ranch in 2000 so that he'd have a nice prop for his 2000 run for the presidency. So, folks in Texas, please don't blame Texas. Come on. Please don't blame Texas. The front page of the Wall Street Journal today. The headline, Fearing a Democratic Victory, Drug Makers Fund Key Races. Now, you recall 2 days ago I had shared with you this story that was in Barron's, which is like the magazine that, I mean, you talk about the rich talking to the rich. Barron's owned by Dow Jones and Company, I believe. The Wall Street Journal folks, not just a very conservative financial publication, but, you know, and not just, you know, Forbes capitalist tool, but Barron's, the publication for people who are filthy rich and interested in staying that way. And they ran this article about how they were saying that the Republicans are going to take the Senate and they're going to hold on to the Senate and they're going to hold on to the House. And the reason why is very simple, because in each one of the races that they've looked at, the Republicans have more money. Now, you could have just taken that on its face value and said, oh, gee, this is, you know, what they're predicting based on the past. I mean, the fact that in past races, the candidate with the most money has won, and they say that that's more accurate than the polls. Or you could look at this as a wink, nod, nudge, as a thinly veiled but relatively overt request to potential funders for Republican candidates to throw money at them. You know, basically, they could have been saying, you know, hey, you guys think that you've got some Republicans who might lose their seats? Give them cash! I mean, right now, the reason why electoral-vote.com is showing that the Republicans are going to hold the Senate is because in Virginia, Mr. Mukaka, George Allen, is essentially tied 46-45 over Admiral Webb, you know, the former Secretary of the Navy. Well, maybe he's not an admiral, but Jim Webb, who, by the way, is going to show up on the ballot as James H. Jim. It's not even going to show his last name on the ballot, because the electronic voting machines just couldn't be programmed to show his last name. But George Allen's name will be there, not to worry. So anyhow, he's got a one-point edge in Virginia right now, according to the latest poll. That was the L.A. Times and Mason poll. In Tennessee, Ford, Corker is running this racist ad against Ford, and Ford is now down to 44%. Corker's up to 47%, the Republican, playing the race card in Tennessee, and it looks like it's working. That from the latest Rasmussen and L.A. Times and Mason-Dixon polls. And in Missouri, Jim Talent holds a one-point lead over McCaskill, again, the L.A. Times poll. So, you know, what's going on with these races? Well, it's all about money, you know, according to Barron's. And here we see this front-page story in the Wall Street Journal, Electoral RX, right? As in prescription, electoral prescription. Hershey, Pennsylvania. John McKinnon wrote the piece. Hershey, Pennsylvania, the Dateline. Few businesses have more at stake in next month's congressional elections than pharmaceutical makers. Now, let me just pause this for a moment and point out that Nancy Pelosi has said that if the Democrats take the House of Representatives in the first 100 hours, she intends to rewrite the Medicare legislation so that the federal government can negotiate with drug companies to get discounts. So that we won't be giving hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, $300 billion a year in excess profits to the pharmaceutical companies. This is one of only two industries, by the way, that has an exemption from antitrust rules. What's wrong with that picture? So back to the Wall Street Journal. Few businesses have more at stake in next month's congressional elections than pharmaceutical makers, assailed by Democrats. Drug companies are pouring millions of dollars into close races, giving some Republicans a financial edge. In other words, that edge that Barron's 3 days ago was predicting is going to cause Republicans to win, it's coming from the pharmaceutical industry. Pennsylvania Republican Rick Santorum is a big beneficiary of the industry's push. He was a leading proponent of the 2003 law that gave seniors Medicare prescription coverage for prescription drugs and helped shape the law in ways that benefited the industry. In other words, it was Ricky Santorum in Pennsylvania who helped write the Medicare law in such a way that when the federal government through Medicare pays for prescription drugs, instead of paying, for example, one of the more common high blood pressure medications costs about $130 a year if you buy it, if the VA buys it, because they go to the drug companies and they say, okay, we're going to buy enough of this stuff for 1 million people. How much does it cost for 10 million tablets or 100 million tablets? They say $130 per year per person. But if you buy it through Medicare, which is actually insuring far more people than the VA, it costs over $1,000 a year. This is thanks to Rick Santorum. Where does that extra $900 go? It goes right into the pockets of the pharmaceutical company, and right now they're emptying part of their pockets and giving it back to Rick Santorum and Orrin Hatch, who got $301,000, and Joe Lieberman, who got $240,000, and Mike Ferguson, the Republican from New Jersey, who got $239,000, and Mike DeWine, who got $214,000, and Nathan Deal in Georgia, who got $183,000, and John Kyle, Republican in Arizona, who got $179,000, and Nancy Johnson, the Republican in Connecticut, who got $171,000. As the Wall Street Journal noted, as John McKinnon wrote, battling to keep his seat in a crucial Senate race, Mr. Santorum's campaign has received almost $500,000 from pharmaceutical interests and their employees. The industry has also helped fund television advertisements and aided get out the vote efforts. So it's actually a whole heck of a lot more than just $500,000. They note few recent elections have been so critical, particularly for the drug industry. As Nancy Pelosi told a group of 100 retirees in Sunrise, Florida earlier this month, quote, it'll take 5 minutes to take, make the biggest change of all, the proposal to let the government negotiate prices for pharmaceuticals. They note other industries are also pouring money into races in hopes of protecting their favorite candidates. Oil and gas interests worry about a Democratic Congress axing subsidies. 83% of their money is going to Republicans. Second largest recipient, Conrad Burns, the Republican who's in trouble in Montana. Or is he in trouble? I don't know. Time will tell. Looks like, you know, maybe he's having a little problem. Electric utilities, fearing tougher environmental rules, have contributed $11.9 million, with 66% going to Republicans. But Mr. Santorum, they say, the biggest recipient of pharmaceutical money, up from 15 the last time he ran in 2000. So that's on the one hand, the corruption of the political process. If Barron's is right, that what's going to make the difference in this election, if what's going to cause Republicans to hold the House and the Senate is money and nothing more than money, period, end of discussion. If Barron's is right, and they say that they're not even saying that cynically, they're simply saying that scientifically. They've looked at elections for the last 25 years, and every single, more or less, and every single time, or 93% of the time, as I recall, or 98% accuracy in midterms, 93% overall, the candidate with the most money wins. If they are right, then what we have right now is a small number of very, very wealthy industries who are getting incredibly rich off you and me. They're bloodsuckers on our backs. The pharmaceutical industry, the health insurance industry, the oil industry, the fossil fuels industry, the electric power, private electric power industry, the private hospital industry. These people are supporting these Republican candidates who are then going to support them. It is probably the most corrupt that this, the political system in the United States has been since the era of the robber barons in the 1880s and 1890s. And what is the result? Well, this is where we go to Germany to find out. Gaber Steingart wrote an article in Der Spiegel, which is the German equivalent of Time magazine. The headline, America's middle class has become globalization's loser. Subhead, at the beginning of the 21st century, the United States is still a superpower, but it's a superpower facing competition from beyond its borders as well as internal difficulties. Its lower and middle classes are turning out to be the losers of globalization. They talk about globalization is striking back. The United States has promoted the worldwide exchange of commodities like no other nation, and the result is that their local industry has begun to be eroded. Some production sectors, such as the furniture industry, consumer electronics, automobile parts suppliers, and now computer manufacturers, have left the country for good. In the recent past, free trade has primarily benefited the very rival nations that are now mounting an economic offensive on the United States, and which have cut off a large slice of America's global market share for themselves. So, and then they go through this extraordinary thing, and new jobs. Well, I'll share it with you after the break about how jobs are collapsing in the United States, investment is collapsing in the United States as a result of global free trade, paid for and promoted by these same politicians who are in the pockets of corporate America. And it's not even corporate America anymore. I mean, you got Halliburton reincorporating offshore so they don't have to pay taxes. 45 minutes past the hour.
5-1, baby. 1 in 5. No one here gets out alive now. You get yours, baby. I'll get mine. Gonna make it, baby, if we try.
Yes, indeed. Hey, you got the guns, but we got the numbers. Here, pop that back up again.
May take a week, and may take longer. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Come on! We are gonna win! Hey, we're going to have a debate, too, by the way. Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, Johnny Steele, and I will be debating Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys in San Francisco. Honorable Willie Brown moderating it. Tickets are free. It's at the University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium, but you have to have a ticket. You can get it over at quakeradio.com. It's the Quake, you know, the San Francisco Air America radio station carries this program. And quakeradio.com, their website, go over there and download a ticket for yourself and for your friends. And then be sure to show up, because we need a whole lot of people cheering on our side if we're going to kick these guys in the, well, whatever. Anyway, okay, back to this piece in Der Spiegel. This, by the way, is written by Gebert Steingart. He's the head of the Berlin office for Der Spiegel, which is, as I said, like Time magazine for Germany. And he was chosen the Economic Writer of the Year in 2004. This guy's a brilliant economic writer. And he talks about how back on October 28, 1998, the U.S. Congress established a commission that included Don Rumsfeld and Robert Zoellick and Ann Kruger, the number two at the IMF, and MIT professor Lester Turow, to figure out what's going on with the U.S. economy. And Gaber Steingart then writes, things were going swimmingly for the Americans until the end of the 1970s, the commission report concluded. Now, keep in mind, the end of the 1970s was the end of the time before Reagan was elected and declared war on the middle class. He goes on to say, family incomes grew virtually at the same rate in all sections of the population during the first three decades after World War II, with those of the poor actually growing slightly faster. The lowest fifth of U.S. society saw a 120% increase in incomes, second fifth, 101%. Third fifth, 104%, the fourth fifth, 114%, and the top fifth, a 94% increase in wealth. It was as if the American dream had manifested itself in statistics. But then in 1980, the trend reversed. And he talks about, you know, capitalists left their home turfs. This is the beginning of the insanity of so-called global free trade. Capitalists left their home turf and went looking for suitable locations to invest in. He talks about between 1985 and 1995, global production increased by a solid 100%, but direct investment abroad, that's outside the United States, increased by 400% during the same period, same time period. The new jobs were created elsewhere, which had to have an effect on family income in the United States. Within the next two decades, that's the first 20 years after the election of Ronald Reagan, the income of the lowest fifth sank by 1.4%. The second fifth of Americans, the next 20%, the bottom 20% lost 1.4% of income. The next 20% managed to gain by 62.2%, the third by 11.1%, and the fourth by 19%. But at the top of the pyramid, where the promoters and planners of globalization reside and those who profit most from it, income gains climbed by 42%. He says the U.S. national economy clearly bears the signs of this break with its golden age, when the country produced prosperity for almost everyone. Until the 1970s, the productive core of the country burned with such a fiery light that it illuminated the entire world. He talks about how we provided dollars and products for everyone. We rebuilt Europe. We rebuilt Japan. We were the world's greatest net exporter and the world's greatest creditor for 40 years. Everything went just the way the economy textbooks say it should. The world's wealthiest nation pumped money and products into the poorer states. The United States used the energy of its own productive core to make other countries grow or at least glimmer. It was indisputably the world center of power, a source of energy radiating out in all directions. And then he says, this undoubtedly superior United States doesn't exist anymore. 26 years of Reaganomics, of insane domestic economic policies, and Clintonomics trade policies, insane international trade policies, have destroyed the American middle class, and now our political fate, if money decides elections, our political fate of this nation is in the hands of the pharmaceutical companies and the drug companies. And any other company that wants to step up to the plate and put enough money into it, the credit card companies, the banking company, I mean, you name it, they've got legislation. This is the death of America. This is the death of the American middle class. This is the death of the American dream. And this is good times for those who make their living getting dividend checks from the Dow Jones Industrials. Yes, the Dow is up. It does not mean the economy is better. It means the economy is better for investors, for the investor class, for that small slice of Americans, that 1 or 2% of Americans who earn most of their income from investment. Yeah, they're doing very well. Thank you very much. They're doing better than anybody else. But the middle class of America is being destroyed. And with it, I'm telling you, with it is going to go. Unless we get a handle on this, unless we take this back, unless we start acting, and frankly, we have to act in the political realm, democracy itself is at risk. Why? Because the rules of the game, the economic rules of trade and domestic policy, have been rigged against the middle class and in favor of big multinational corporations. So where Halliburton reincorporates KBR offshore so they can avoid tax, I mean, the whole bit. We have to change the rules of the game, and because the rules of the game are set in Congress, we have to change Congress. That's what it comes down to. That's why it's so important that you show up, that you go to MoveOn.org and you say, yes, I will make those phone calls. That you show up at your county Democratic office and say, yes, I will go door to door. That you toss $10, $20, $30 to a Democratic candidate who's out there fighting the good fight. We'll be back after the news with Jeffrey Feldman.
Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Framing in all its dimensions. The man who knows framing inside out. How do you frame framing, Jeffrey Feldman?
How do you frame framing? That's a good question. Persuasiveness.
That's a good one. Yeah. So Mr. Persuasive, Jeffrey Feldman is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. Don't go to FrameShop.com because that's a porn site, as I recall. But FrameShopIsOpen.com is a fine location. Jeffrey, what's the frame of the day?
Well, the big issue coming out of the RNC is this new ad that they've just put up on their website, and it's getting some circulation. The title of the ad is called Stakes. And it is essentially an Al-Qaeda recruitment video that has been produced by the Republican National Committee. And what's really interesting about this particular ad is that the reaction in the media has largely been this critique that this is an ad that carries the message, if you vote for Democrats, then the terrorists are going to kill all Americans. This scare tactic that the Republicans have been using for quite some time. Mm. But if you actually look at the video, what's fascinating is, obviously, the word Democrat is not really in there. It's not until the very last second of this ad that they flash up on the screen this enigmatic sentence, these are the stakes, vote November 7th, and then there's the disclaimer in Ken Melman's voice from the Republican National Committee. They're responsible for what's in the ad. And what I find really, really interesting about this is how it seems to use this aesthetic of teen cool in order to present what Al-Qaeda is, as if... You know, the Republicans are using these images of Al-Qaeda fighters. They're masked. They almost look like ninjas. They're throwing karate kicks. And it's this incredibly vague idea. It really does seem on the surface level that the RNC has produced a fantastic Al-Qaeda recruitment video. And so I think it's really important for the Democrats not to get suckered too much into being defensive about this ad, drawing into what the Republicans want them to do.
You think they should go on the offensive instead and say, hey, wait a minute, you guys just did a 60-second video that's going to cause impressionable American teenagers, maybe, you know, gangbangers, kids who are at law, at sea, you know, who aren't well-rooted in our society and, you know, broken families, whatever, might cause them to actually think that becoming an Al-Qaeda terrorist is a cool thing?
Or at least be fascinated by this ad. I mean, absolutely, that the Democrats need to go on the offense when it comes to this and ask the very basic question, why have the Republicans produced this slick, appealing, Hollywood chic, action-packed ad featuring the words and same exciting imagery that Al-Qaeda uses to recruit its own members? And for all intents and purposes, this is a glitzy, successful recruiting ad that they've made on behalf of the enemy of the United States. And that's really the question that the Democrats need to focus on and not worry that this is an ad that's once again going to convince Americans that Democrats are weak on defense. That's a very, very weak approach to take. Now, there have been some strong voices in the media who have obviously already made that. In particular, Keith Olbermann the other night made this incredible gave this incredible piece in which he took down this video in very strong terms, saying exactly what I'm warning people about. He talked about how this was a very broad scare tactic.
Keith Olbermann has become this generation's Edward R. Murrow.
Yeah, it was an incredible. My wife and I sat around and we listened to this video. It was really, really incredible to hear what Olbermann had to say. And I think that what he's doing, that very, very strong reaction against the president when it comes to this ad, that's an important part that the media can play. But the Democrats running election campaigns in the states, they really need to go on the offensive against this ad and ask questions about why so much RNC money has been put into producing this really slick, action-packed recruitment video.
Jeffrey Feldman, Frame Shop is open. There's a certain schizophrenia about George W. Bush right now. On the one hand, we have him saying things like,
"We will stay the course. We will complete the job in Iraq."
The second thing you do is you stay the course. But on the other hand, you also cannot be a president in a wartime and not realize that you've got to stay the course.
We will stay the course. We will stay the course until the job is done, Steve. And the temptation is to try to get the president or somebody to put a timetable on the definition of getting the job done. We're just going to stay the course. And my message today to those in Iraq is we'll stay the course.
People are going to want more of it, and that's why the president's determined to stay the course, April.
And that's why we're going to stay the course in Iraq. And that's why when we say something in Iraq, we're going to do it. And so we've got tough action in Iraq. But we will stay the course.
Now, it turns out that he's said this over 1,000 times. Now, granted, many of those were on campaign stops, so it was the same old stump speech given in, you know, six cities a day, 7 days a week leading up to the 2004 election. But nonetheless, he said it over 1,000 times. Either earlier today or yesterday, I think it was yesterday afternoon, his spokesman, Tony Snow, said, well, maybe he said stay the course 8 times. And then today he has a news conference where he essentially says, we're going to stay the course. You know, we had Helen Thomas on in the last hour, and she was like, you know, she'd just come back from the news conference. She said, people are going to continue to die because of this man.
Yeah, I mean, and if you dare to climb inside the logic of George W. Bush this week, what he's trying to explain is that the phrase "stay the course" actually means changing all the time. This is the verbal acrobatics that the president is trying to pass off on the public right now are really quite astounding. He gave a speech on the 21st. Just recently, his radio address, in which he said that our goal, that his goal in Iraq, was unchanging, but that the tactics had always been to change on the ground all the time. So the president is attempting, with the help of Tony Snow, who's actually much more capable than he is, but he's attempting to redefine the idea of unchanging as being to change all the time.
Because he can't take back the language.
He can't take back the language.
He can't say I didn't say that. I mean, they've tried that, and it didn't wash. The American public didn't buy it. So now they're having to say, okay, yeah, we said that, but it meant something different than what you think.
Exactly. It's this notion that we're going straight ahead, and we're never going to change our course, and yet our course is, at every opportunity, we are adapting. And so there's this phrase, flexible tactics, that has been used a few times in the past. But flexible is quite an ambiguous phrase to use. And if you actually look at what Bush is saying, he's repeating this word, changed, changing, all over and over and over again, in order to give people the impression that, in fact, on the ground, we are adapting, we're responding, and yet our goal has always been the same. So it is, as you said, this schizophrenia that the president is essentially trying to redefine black as white and pass it off on the public at this time when even the Republican base is calling for a change in the policy.
Yeah, it reminds me very much of the month before the invasion, when the invasion was all set and was planned and was happening, and Bush was confronted by that at a press conference, and he got rather testy.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah. So
yeah, he's the deciderer, and he's also the changerer this week.
Yeah.
And we're going to hear this a lot in the next few days, because I really think that they've put a lot into this new explanation, and they must be polling it and seeing that it's accomplishing something.
Yeah, Frank Luntz did his focus groups and you know, his whole little NLP thing, and yeah, gee whiz, this works. Louise has a T-shirt. One of our listeners sent to us. This says, "In a democracy, we are the deciders." You know, exactly. We the people are the deciders. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com. What do you see coming down the road? What are the frames that you see emerging in the final here, 12 days or so before the election?
I think taxes are going to come up on the radar fairly soon. That you know, the Republicans have staked everything on fear campaigns, and so they're spending all their money initially on the fear of terrorism. But we're going to see, I think, a lot in the next week also, this attempt to reconnect on bread and butter issues and to convince people who may be frustrated with the Iraq policy that you elect Democrats. The second the Democrats take over, then they're just going to kick up taxes incredibly. And there really is a struggle in the ground war, the get out the vote war, to appeal to voters who may be uncomfortable with Democrats on certain social issues, and yet are with them on economic issues. And so I think that the Republicans may see that as the last front, this idea that the Democrats are just going to take all your money once they're in office.
This plays to the Rove idea of attack people at their strengths. And the strength of the Democrats right now is that the economy is in the toilet for the average middle-class person, so the Republicans will attack the Democrats at that level.
Yeah, they're going to go exactly at that. And, you know, Democrats need to respond the way they have in the past. I think it's very effective just to focus on this incredible out-of-control spending going on in all branches of the Republican government right now. That is a real, real issue for people who are looking at economics.
Democrats should be talking about the birth tax. You know, every baby born is born with a $28,000 debt right now, thanks to Bush and Reagan. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, the website. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. Right now, time for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Today's question: big drug companies have just dropped $500,000 into whose senatorial campaign? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, gets an autographed copy of Scrode, 16 minutes past the hour.
All the stories have been told of kings and days of old. But there's no England now. All the wars that were won or lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore. All the lies we were told, all the lies of the people running round their castles are burned. Our eyes see change. But inside, we're the same as we ever were.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of By and For. We the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. Running on about 3 hours of sleep last night up until nearly midnight. Al Gore was in town. What a hoot. And now I'm sneezing here. If I have to pop off for a minute, it's because I pushed the sneeze button. Anyhow, congratulations. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question, once again, was big drug companies have just dropped $500,000 into whose senatorial campaign, according to the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. And congratulations to Shannon Minnickin. Oh, there goes the sneeze. Shannon Minnickin in Friday Harbor, Washington. Congratulations, Shannon. Shannon knew that the correct answer is Ricky Santorum. Good old Ricky Santorum. Yeah. What would we do without him? Well, what will we do without him? It'll be a fine thing, actually, when Bob Casey takes over the Senate. And America, you know, is back to being American. What a fine thing. I want to just wrap this thing up about America's middle class. And, well, in fact, let me wrap it up with you guys. There's some folks here on the line who want to discuss these issues. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Lynette in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Lynette, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. What's on your mind today?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I wanted to tell you about a woman who's here in Bellingham, Washington. with a book that she wrote, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time.
Uh-huh.
And her name is Antonia Junhaz, J-U-H-A-S-Z. And she's amazing. She's speaking here, and this book is also connecting the dots in a way that I haven't read in anything before.
Well, that's great. The Bush Agenda is the title of the book. What's, Lynette, you want to give us a 30-second summary of it or just plug the book?
Yeah.
I mean, what did you learn?
Well, I learned about the, like, how this all came about, what it's all about in detail, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, all the things that have come about that have really caused this invading the world one economy at the time and what
right.
has happened.
Yeah, it really is the invading the economy one at a time. Well said, Lynette. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. It's grim stuff, I'm telling you. It's grim stuff. David in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. I regard you very highly, and I think your program is more effective than the others in conveying the messages that you do.
Well, thank you.
Because I think a lot of the other shows actually alienate people.
Well, this isn't a competition. I mean, we're just doing the best radio we can, and...
Well, you do a terrific job with it. I am from Virginia, and I wanted to know a little bit more about Webb and why his whole name isn't being put on the ballots.
Because when he submitted his name to when it was originally put on the campaign thing, when you first fill out the yes, I want to run for a political office.
Right.
He did the same thing that Jimmy Carter did. Jimmy Carter's, it asked for the name as you wanted to appear on the ballot. And Jimmy Carter, if you remember that presidential election, it said James Earl, or James parenthesis, quote, Jimmy, close parenthesis, Earl Carter. That's when you voted for Jimmy Carter, that's what it said. If you voted for Bill Clinton, it said William parenthesis, quote, Bill, close parenthesis, Jefferson Clinton.
Uh-huh.
And Jim Webb goes by the name Jim, although his name is James.
Mm-hmm.
And he just asked everybody to call him Jim, and everybody knows him as Jim. And so when he submitted his name, it was James, quote, James H., period, quote, or parenthesis, Jim, in quotes, close parenthesis, Webb. Well, it turns out that's too many letters to fit on the screen that the voting machine company programmed those screens for. And, of course, this is all programmable. I mean, it's just, define the number of pixels in a box, right, or the number of characters on a line.
Right.
But so his name is going to appear on the electronic voting machines in Virginia as James, parenthesis, Jim, H, period.
Oh, great.
No Webb. So James Jim is going to be running against Mr. Mukaka. It's what's his name?
George Allen.
Yeah.
Is this the only state that you're aware of this going on in?
Yep, so far.
And George Allen manages to fit his whole name in, of course, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, George Allen's name fits. Jim Webb's name doesn't fit. Go figure.
Okay.
So that's the story.
Yeah, I wanted to fire a question at you about the Second Amendment. Because you made a statement about the American military and no one being able to stand up to it.
Yeah, hang on just a minute then. We'll
pick
that up on the other side of the break. Actually, it may be a little beyond that because we've got a guest. Chris Hedges is going to be with us. But if you want to hang on through that, I'll be taking calls after that. So stick around. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to be America. My daddy used to know where right was right and not political code. Respected you and me, the America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The former Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, author of the bestseller War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. On the line with us, Chris Hedges, Currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City and a lecturer at the Council of the Humanities and the Anschutz Distinguished Fellow at Princeton University. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Am I pronouncing the distinguished fellow part right?
I think so.
Okay.
I never get that far into the title.
I see. All righty. First of all, I just want to congratulate is the wrong word. I want to honor you for this the brilliant work, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning.
Oh, thanks.
It should be in everybody's home. You have written two pieces recently that I wanted to talk with you about. The first was on October 9th. It was posted over at truthdig.com. And it starts out, the aircraft carrier Eisenhower, accompanied by guided missile cruiser, you know, and it goes through this whole thing that they're steaming off to Iran. Well, they arrived yesterday, I believe. And it was titled Bush's Nuclear Apocalypse. And the second is a piece that you wrote a couple of days ago, October 23rd. It was posted over at TruthDig, in which you were talking about coveting the Holocaust, that there's this idea of a war, I guess, as a force that gives us meaning. Is there a 2+2 here?
You mean with Iran and
with the fleet going into Iran and with Bush's rhetoric and with his worldview? And I mean, what do you see happening and why?
Well, I look at the Bush administration as a, you know, in many ways a new phenomenon in American politics. They have embraced a radicalism that I don't think we've seen in my mind in sort of previous administrations.
Even the McKinley administration.
Yeah, I mean, these people have adopted Leon Trotsky's notion of sort of permanent revolution and twisted it that's slightly on its head by calling it permanent war. But the object is the same, and that is to destabilize and frighten all countries outside our borders that we classify as hostile or as enemies, to cow domestic critics and keep the domestic populace in a kind of suspended state of fear, and it allows them to speak in the only language by which they know how to speak, and that is through violence. And that is an extremely frightening, if you believe that is the sort of core of their ideological system, which I do, and you match that with the kind of rhetoric that has been going on within the sort of hard right of the neocons for a long time towards Iran, that becomes a very frightening scenario. I am not obviously privy to any. We know that from reporting by Cy Hirsch and others that there certainly are contingency plans, although there's contingency plans for a lot of things, that there are special forces units inside Iran that can call in strikes on selected targets, roughly 1,000 sites that they have linked to Iranians' nuclear weapons program. But when you couple that activity, those plans, with the ideological belief system of the Bush administration, if you buy this notion, which I do, that they really have adopted this doctrine of permanent war, then I think the chances of them hitting Iran before Bush leaves office are pretty good.
What, you know, there's a huge cheering squad, you know. There are a lot of cheerleaders for the Bush administration for this kind of thing. Certainly, when it was the Iraq invasion, the cheerleading wasn't just limited to the Republicans in Congress. It extended throughout the American media. Even many Democrats got in on the act. I'm curious, what percentage of those folks who were advocating the use of violence against Iraq, as opposed to keeping the inspectors in for another month or so and, you know, continuing sanctions and things like that, what percentage of those folks do you think were doing it because they actually embrace the ideology of war as a force that gives us meaning? I keep coming back to that phrase. It's so well turned, and I don't know how to say it better. As opposed to embracing it because it was simply politically expedient, or they were actually just terrified by the drumbeat that the Bush administration was putting together. And once you've defined that, how does that translate into, you know, where is the hardcore lovers of violence versus the more rational people who might make a case for violence, but not because they love violence, in the Bush administration now?
Well, of course, it ran the gamut. I mean, you had people like Michael Ignatieff or David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, calling themselves reluctant hawks, supporting the Bush administration with reluctance on the invasion in Iraq, all the way over to those people, Richard Perle and company, who just couldn't wait to start the war. I think that a large part of the American populace, but this, again, touches on a point you made, because of the complete lack of criticism or self-reflection as part of that debate in the build-up to the war in Iraq, courtesy of a very compliant and cowed mainstream media, meant that a lot of people got into it. And I think, you know, we forget that it wasn't just the Bush administration, but the complicity on the part of many Americans who relished the thought of whacking Iraq and got off on the cable news channels with their graphics and drumbeats and, retired generals talking about how powerful our weapons were and, of course, by extension, our own power. I think that is the sort of dark enticement of war and violence. And that's always going to be there. That's a really hard and a hard and difficult lust to counter, especially in the case of Iran. I mean, this is a really horrendous regime. I've worked there. I spent a lot of time there. I've been deported and handcuffed from Iran. I have no love for these guys at all. They are clearly trying to build a nuclear capacity. There's no question about that. They would be dangerous if they got it. The question is, how do you deal with it? And dropping iron fragmentation bombs and cruise missiles all over Iran, for the people such as myself who've spent many years in the Middle East, is just really almost an apocalyptic scenario, because it would the whole Middle East would unravel. The Shiite population in Saudi Arabia, which controls much of the oil production, would certainly have deep sympathies for the Shiites under attack in Iran. This would unite the Shiite and Sunni insurgents in a way that they've never been able to unite before against the American occupiers. You have a Shiite majority in Bahrain, huge Shiite majorities in Pakistan. The Straits of Hormuz, which are very narrow, would I think 40% of the world's oil goes through it, would come under attack from Iranian Silkworm missile. I mean, the possibility, and not to mention the fact that oil would shoot up over $110 a barrel, some people say over $200 a barrel, triggering a kind of global recession or depression. I mean, the consequences of this are just staggering.
And yet these guys are, in your opinion, planning on going ahead with it.
From everything,
what
I think
possible
certainly
rationale could they have, given that what you're laying out, this is not rocket science. I mean, back before they invaded Iraq, millions of us were out in the streets saying, and people like, you know, Congressman Jim McDermott, who actually went over to Iraq before we invaded and came back and gave a speech in a church that I attended. You know, I heard this in Seattle, and said, you know, if we go in there, it's going to be hand-to-hand combat in the streets.
Right.
And Wolfowitz laughed at it and said, ah, come on, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. But he was right. Jim McDermott was right. And I believe that you're right. And this is not rocket science. These guys have to understand that what you're saying is true. Is it that they're embracing the idea of a Holocaust?
I think they don't live in a reality-based world. I mean, there were no shortage of people in leading up to the war with Iraq within the State Department, within the intelligence community, even within the Pentagon. We know because of Shinseki's resignation and even Colin Powell. I mean, a lot of people did not think that this rosy scenario of marching into Iraq and occupying Baghdad was ever going to fly. But what did they do? They just stopped listening to them. They are completely deaf and dumb. They are.
But that, you know, that sounds very glib, Chris Hedges. I mean, there has to be a reason, is it? Or is it that we're being governed by people with IQs, you know, that are roughly that of room temperature?
Well, it's not so much. They're people of. I think it's more emotional. You know, I think that, I mean, if you look at a figure like Elliot Abrams, who, when I covered the Contra War in Nicaragua, was in charge of the Contra War under the Reagan administration, he knows nothing about Central America. I don't think he speaks Spanish, as far as I know. He's now running our policy in the Middle East out of the NSC. This is a guy who lives in a fantasy world. He believes in our own invulnerability. He believes in the capacity of violence to reshape and change a world he knows nothing about. And I think in that, you know, a lot of the people who were the wackos in the Reagan administration, who George Shultz and James Baker and others kept on the fringes, have now moved into the center. And I think we really are dealing with people who are living in a non-reality-based world, and that's what's so frightening.
It is. And all the more reason that we need to get politically active and take back the House and Senate. Maybe we can put a break on it. Chris Hedges, I encourage you to get his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. A great, great writer, great author. Chris, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour.
Hey, W. Hey, W. We just can't get another you. And it isn't the way that you turn a phrase or the look in your eye of a faraway haze. Hey, W. Don't want to trouble you. And I don't want to burst that bubble you have us all in, safe from all sin. We feel born again and again. And again.
And again. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. By the way, our October surprise contest is coming up. First person to post the correct answer to What's the Bush Administration's October Surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner, and four runners-up each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed. The winner will be announced November 13th on our message board over at TomHartman.com. And, of course, that's where you also can enter the contest, TomHartman.com. Victoria Jones on the line with us, our disappointed press conference senior correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com in Washington, D.C., an accredited and legitimate member of the White House Press Corps, Victoria Jones.
Yes, well, that is me, and it is I, and I was wearing a red jacket, and he still didn't call on me.
Oh, my. Oh,
I couldn't have done much more unless I stood up.
Maybe if you wore a swastika.
Oh!
I'm sorry. It was a momentary outburst there.
Got carried away, didn't you?
Yeah, it's my Asperger's or something. I don't know what it is.
Right.
And in any case, it's
goodness.
Photos of bombs fall. I just had this conversation with Chris Hedges, the guy who wrote War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and the picture that he's painting of the people inside this administration is sociopathic to be gentle. And
really?
just tremendously concerns me that they, you know, that they just love killing people, basically. And, you know, that they love war, that it satisfies some deep need that they have. And it was a very sobering conversation. So the press conference this morning, my take on it, I didn't hear the whole thing. I was on the air throughout the press conference, but I got all the AP feeds and I heard the clips and I've seen all the things on the various, you know, right and left wing websites that talk about the press conference. And my sense of it was that Bush was basically saying, we're not going to say stay the course, but by the way, we're going to stay the course.
And
more people are going to die.
That's right. Yes, more people are going to die. We're not staying the course, but we're staying the course. I would call it staying the course plus.
Yeah.
Because we're going to stay the course plus we're going to do these things, and we were given a list of things that we're going to do, which all sounded, they sounded like good things to do, but they were the kinds of things that I would have thought we would already be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it occurred to me, but I wasn't asked, to ask, are we already doing these things, and if not, why not?
Yeah, and why not over the last 4 years, by the way? In fact, we had Helen Thomas on the first hour of the program, and she had just come out of the press conference, and she just sounded sad. It's really startling when you hear Helen Thomas. She just said, well, I just came from the press conference, and more people are going to die.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
And Americans are going to vote for this?
Well, I'm not sure that they're going to vote for this, but I'm not sure that they're going to vote for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be the crucial thing. And this is what the Democrats have got to do in the next couple of weeks. They may have peaked too soon. You know what it's like when sometimes when you're making a souffle and you open that door too soon and suddenly it all starts to drop.
No, I don't know that. I've never done that, but I can imagine.
That's what happens. And,
okay.
And you've got to keep the door closed until it's absolutely ready.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that the Democrats have kept that door closed. So if from the Democrats' point of view, this has to be a little bit worrying. And the president holding two press conferences in a month, he has never, ever done that before. Mm. There are rumors in the press corps that he will do another one before the election.
Mm-hmm. He's getting quite confident of his own abilities. Now, we talked a couple days ago about how the Barron said that whoever has the most money wins the election, period, in any race. And today's front page story in the Wall Street Journal, how these major industries, they've profiled the drug industry, but they mentioned peripherally others, are basically showering cash on Republican candidates now. I'm wondering if that's the result of the Barron's article, pointing out that whoever has the most money wins, or if the Barron's article and the Wall Street Journal article are simply both reporting something that's already, you know, been known for a long, long time, and you know, that whoever has the most cash wins, and that this is the main core of the Republican strategy to hold on to the House and the Senate.
I would think it's both. I mean, I would think they already certainly think that if you've got more cash, you can get better ads on TV and you can get the vote out better. But it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, people do think Barron's is pretty influential, and they know they've only got 2 weeks, that they would start showering cash. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it's as a result of this article.
I would say anybody in America who could write a $500,000 check would be reading Barron's in all probability.
I would think you would be right, and they probably wouldn't be writing the check to the Democrats. So the Democrats have to be clever. They've got 2 weeks, and they have to be clever if they haven't got that kind of cash.
Right. And actually, they're doing some good stuff. And some of the groups associated with them, MoveOn.org, for example, this giant phone banking operation, they're doing some really good stuff and you know, to get out the vote. Because on midterm elections like this, typically, I mean, you have, a quarter of voters actually show up? I don't remember the
Not
exact
many.
Number. It's about half of what it is for the main elections, you know, for the presidential elections. And so basically your vote is magnified by two. You know, your vote has twice as much impact as if this were a presidential election. And by the way, if you don't think George W. Bush is on the ballot this time, think again, because if the Democrats do take control and they do start holding hearings, even if they swear up and down they're not going to impeach, when they start finding out some of the crimes that this guy's committed, they're not going to have any choice. They're going to have to impeach him.
And you know, even if they don't impeach him, so what? The 2008.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's not going to run in 2008, but I mean, there's just an enormous amount of damage that can be done between now and then. I'm concerned that he's going to start a war with Iran.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sorry I didn't make your day, Victoria.
Oh.
Usually we can make each other smile. But anyway, good talking with you.
Talking to you.
Keep up the great work there over at TalkRadioNews.com. Victoria Jones with us. We'll be back after the top of the hour. Alex Jones, radio host, conspiracy theorist, filmmaker, Infowars.com. He's going to be with us. Larry Scott, VA Watchdog. And then at the bottom of the next hour, we'll start taking your calls and wrap up the hour that way. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day from Dwight Eisenhower. Freedom has its life in the hearts, the actions, the spirits of men, so it must be daily earned and refreshed. Else, like a flower cut from its life-giving roots, it will wither and die. Sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes what you don't know that you don't know is what's going to get you, and sometimes even what you know is wrong. Sometimes everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it all a giant conspiracy? Is it possible everything we know is wrong? Alex Jones is here with us from Infowars.com. He's a radio talk show host, conspiracy theorist, filmmaker. He has a new film out called Terror Storm. Hey, Alex.
Thank you for having me on, Tom. Yes, the neocons are using staged and provocateur terror to terrorize the American people into submitting to their tyranny, to the H.R. 6166 Military Commissions Act that does affect American citizens. We have the documents and the subsections up on PrisonPlanet.com and InfoWars.com. And starting October 31st nationwide in Barnes & Nobles and Virgin Atlantic, we will have Terror Storm in stores all across the country. The history of government-sponsored terror. We show how the Gulf of Tonkin was staged, now declassified. We show how our own government staged terror attacks in 53 in Iran to blame it on pro-America Mohammad Mossadegh, which then caused the chain of events we see with the crises brewing today. We show how Hitler staged attacks on his own military base to launch the war against Poland in 1939. And then we get into the 7/7 bombings in London. We cover 9/11, clearly an inside job. We show all the evidence, all the documents, the controlled demolition, Operation Northwoods, the official U.S. government plan to stage 9/11-style attacks at that time to blame it on Cuba and the Soviets. And we walk through the history of government-sponsored terror. That's why this is so important. And folks can also watch Terror Storm for absolutely free. If they go to InfoWars.com, they can look for a link that says Watch Terror Storm for free. It looks pretty darn good. It's up on Google Video. Millions of people have watched it. Google Video admits they keep erasing our counters, so we won't be in the top 100, but we've been there three times. Millions of people have already seen it free. People say, well, why are you giving it out free? This information is too important, too vital. I just beg everyone, including yourself, Mr. Hartman, to please go to InfoWars.com to click on the link and to spend 114 minutes, just shy of 2 hours, watching my new documentary film, Terror Storm. And it's filled with experts, engineers, scientists, former members of MI5, former CIA, top-level officers.
I got it, Alex. I got it. it's,
take a breath, Alex.
I'm drinking out of the fire hose here. It's I got it. And let's just talk about a few of these things. For example, one of the ones that has really troubled me is that just as the Patriot Act was being put before the United States Congress, The only two men in the United States Senate, the Senate had flipped to the control of the Democrats because Jim Jeffords had defected from the Republican Party.
The only people were Democrats, and the White House was on the drug that
let me just finish the setup, and then you can rant on it, because I want to hear your take on it. But first of all, tell me if my setup is right on this. The only two guys who could have stopped the Patriot Act were the guy who could have prevented it from getting out of the Judiciary Committee, the head of the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, and Tom Daschle, the guy who decided what comes to the floor for a vote, the head of the Democrats in the Senate, Tom Daschle, the Democrat from South Dakota, as I recall. And by coincidence, those were the only two guys who got anthrax in the mail. Is there some connection?
Well, they aren't the only two. Then the editor who published...
Well, I mean the only two guys in Congress.
Exactly. The only other person, of course, was the fellow who wrote big pieces on the Bush, the daughter's drunkenness and debauchery falling down on each other. He also got a special mailing, and then the government was able to grab the entire archives of American media in Boca Raton. But yes, weaponized anthrax, U.S. British patented, coated in bentonite, $100+ million process just for the equipment, from Fort Detrick, Maryland. It gets mailed to all the key individuals, and then on October 27th, 2001, the USA Patriot Act was rammed through, and then the White House press secretary had to admit a month into the attacks that, on September 10th, almost the entire cabinet did go on the anthrax-fighting antibiotic Cipro. But again, that's all just a coincidence.
It's just a coincidence. So why the thing that baffles me, Alex Jones, InfoWars.com and PrisonPlanet.com, the thing that baffles me, Alex, is, you know, there's no shortage of discussion about conspiracies around 9/11, and you know, and I know your position on those, and you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion about
total inside job.
Sure, but nobody is discussing the anthrax. Nobody is discussing the anthrax.
You're
it's
right.
It's like it never happened. Why is nobody discussing this?
Well, it's kind of like nobody's discussing Bin Laden, and Bush says he doesn't care where he is and isn't thinking about him, because that was done at that time to keep the fear going, to shut down most of the office buildings in D.C. There around the Capitol, and to put FBI-armed paramilitary police in the halls. They also threatened members of the Senate on intelligence releases because info was coming out about prior knowledge and the famous Condoleezza Rice memo. So it was more than just ramming through the Patriot Act. It was a way of really scaring people. And, yeah, we should talk about the anthrax. They tried to blame a bunch of innocent people. They tried to claim somebody could cook it up in a bathtub or with a bucket or in a barrel. No, it was super weaponized U.S./British anthrax, the strain out of Fort Detrick. Again, each spore had been miniaturized. That takes tens of millions of dollars of equipment. And the coating in bentonite, basically they put wings on every spore so it flies through the air like pollen.
Right.
And it's a micro, really it's at the level of nanotech to be able to do this. And so it was not done in a bucket, as they claimed. And again, the White House was on Ship Row.
So who do you think did this?
The black ops squads, black world squads inside the military industrial complex, the same people that carried out 9/11, the same people Bush had the White House memo with Blair about staging WMD fines and getting planes shot down and flying them low.
Do you think that George W. Bush himself was one of the conspirators in this?
Even a really smart person like Clinton has all these advisors and basically gets advised on what to do and is given the policy and then, oversees it. Bush doesn't even do that. So when certainly Dick Cheney is a decision maker, and then people above him, the big defense contractors that have been making hundreds of billions a year, the oil companies that make trillions a year by seizing the oil in Afghanistan and the stands in Iraq and not allowing any of that oil to flow. People, liberals keep saying.
Now, you think these guys are making decisions, or do you think these guys are just going along for the ride and making the bucks?
I would have to say they're aware of the operations after they're happening. They're aware the operations are being launched.
So it's a wink and a nod.
But I'd have to say that Bush isn't really in the loop. Cheney is in the loop. And we know that from 9/11. We have the Defense Department official order 2 months before 9/11, June 3rd, still available from government websites, where since 57 generals and their designates, it was the default position to shoot down hijacked aircraft. And 2 months before, Cheney took that power away from anyone but himself and Rumsfeld. And then as the Transportation Secretary Mineta testified, he's in the White House bunker underground, and the aide walks in and says it's 50 miles out, it's 30 miles out, it's 20, it's 5. Does the order still stand, sir? And he said, of course it still stands. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And you can go watch Mineta give that testimony. We know that they ordered that stand down. And we know that they're hurtling us towards World War III. We know they're building FEMA camps.
Which brings me to the wrap on this, because we only have about a minute left. We're talking with Alex Jones, Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com. He has a new movie out called Terror Storm. It's going to be in bookstores all over the country. Alex, what do you see coming? I mean, if your scenario is correct, that so many of these things have been set up by the government in order to terrify us and in order to seize control and seize wealth, what do you see coming? I mean, we have elections coming up now. We have elections in 2 years.
I see Diebold is in 35% of the precincts in the country. Diebold, Hardiner Civics, and others.
Sure.
These questionable machines are in place. I see them still losing some seats because they can't steal it everywhere. I see them paying off the Democrats or leveraging them to not go for impeachment.
Do you see more
like
terror attacks?
Pardon me?
Do you see more terror attacks?
If the crime syndicate running our government needs to, they will, or they may launch us into World War III with Iran. That'll do the same thing. That's why getting the word out about how criminal they are, it could save this republic. If not, we're going into a Nazi Germany system, and it was President Bush's grandfather who was the top Nazi agent in this country. That is real, folks. National Archives, I've been there. I made a film, Martial Law.
Well, Roosevelt outed him, took away his bank.
Yeah, exactly. They had
it was in the New York Times. It's Prescott Bush.
Smedley Butler, the top Marine Corps general, went public and said they tried to hire him.
Yeah, he wrote a book about it, War is a Racket. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. The Nazis tried to take over this country in the late 30s, folks, and they almost did it. They were 2 inches. So listen, they couldn't do it then. They're doing it now. You can also buy the DVD of Terror Storm right now at Infowars.com. It's available right now. It's also available to the distributor that put out Outfoxed, Disinformation.com. It could, because it's real information. It's a tongue-in-cheek term.
Got it. Alex, we're out of time.
Nationwide. God bless you.
Okay, thank you, Alex, and you too. Infowars.com. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy right here in the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, welcome to our newest affiliate, WRVC, AM 930 in Huntington, West Virginia. Thank you for putting us on the air on your radio station. We much appreciate it, and we encourage our listeners to thank you as well and to patronize your sponsors. Larry Scott is with us with VA. Excuse me, I just got distracted. Larry Scott is with us with VAWatchdog.org. So keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
That is absolutely right. Greetings to our friends in Huntington. That's good news to hear.
Indeed.
A new affiliate, Tom.
Indeed. Always, always nice.
And I've been practicing. I've been trying to speak as fast as Alec Jones. I can't do it.
Well, when you reach the point where you do, then you get the everything is, you know, is wrong.
I do not have to drink coffee though for 2 or 3 days after listening to the segment with Alex.
Alex is a heck of a guy. He paints some really disturbing pictures. He has an extraordinary grasp of information, and I don't go all the way down the road with him on a lot of things, but I'll go half of the way, sometimes all the way on a lot of these things, and he's an important voice, I think.
Exactly, I think he is, and I think it's worth listening to and looking at what he offers, and then you have to make your own decisions at that point of view, and I think I'm with you. I'm about a third to a half with what Alex does.
Yeah, but it's an important voice, and we'll continue to put him on.
Right. Let me just take a second to announce the formation of VA Watchdog Productions.
Okay.
Full-blown video unit for VAWatchdog.org. We're going to begin very, very shortly shooting a whole series of documentaries that we'll be releasing on DVD on veterans in the United States today and how they deal with the VA and how the VA has let them down. And we're going to start back with World War II vets, go through Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, also the Balkans, and right now, Iraq and Afghanistan. That's going to be our first project. I'd just like to let your listeners know, and we'll have the first product out in probably about 7 or 8 months.
That's marvelous, Larry. Larry, here's a question that's, I'm looking at your website right now, vawatchdog.org, and Vets Commission votes not to recommend lump sum payouts of VA disability benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that's a good thing.
Yes, that's a very good thing.
Okay. GAO report tells VA to tighten up individual unemployment. You know, some of these things. The veterans are getting screwed. I mean, you know, the bottom line is more often than not, veterans are getting the short end of the stick here. And on the one hand, you want to have some confidence and trust in a representative democratic republic. You know, here we are. And we should be able to take care of our veterans and take care of our own. And on the other hand, the extent to which we trash the Veterans Administration is the extent to which the cons come along and say, see, we told you government can't do anything right. There shouldn't be any Veterans Administration. Let's just do away with it. Veterans should go on their own. Give a lump sum when they get out, you know, let them know what the risks are up front. I mean, you know, there's actually conservatives, and a fair number of them actually, true, out there, who say, you know, the Veterans Administration, it's socialism.
Of course, they can prove without a doubt that the VA doesn't work, and how they do it is they underfund it. We saw this with Katrina. I swear to you, Tom, that the government wanted the relief efforts of FEMA after the Katrina disaster to fail, because then they could prove, see, big government doesn't work. We need smaller government. We need to use subcontractors. They're doing the same thing with the VA.
Although what's amazing is Katrina was followed by Wilma, which most people don't remember. And Wilma was actually a Category 4 when it hit landfall in Florida, whereas Katrina was only a Cat 3 when it hit landfall in Louisiana and Mississippi. And Wilma caused considerable damage. And FEMA was down there, and they fixed up Florida just fine, very quickly, thank you very much.
I think a lot of that had to do with the local intervention, too, though, if I remember correctly.
I think a lot of that had to do with a lot of FEMA dollars coming down there from Washington, D.C., too.
It was
Jeb Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Well, the government can prove that big government doesn't work when they have institutions like the VA that's meant to serve veterans, and then they underfund it. They deliberately underfund it. They deliberately do not send money out to the hospitals. We have GAO reports about that earlier this year where hospitals were not getting money, over $50 million meant for mental health care. And then they can say, well, you see, the system doesn't work. Our hospitals can't take care of the people they're supposed to take care of, but they deliberately don't send them enough money. That's why right at the top of VAWatchdog.org right now is a vote pro-veteran banner. And all our, you know, your listeners, your veterans have to do is click on it. They can find out who's been supporting veterans, who hasn't been supporting veterans, not with what they say, but with their votes in Congress, which is very, they all talk the talk, but do they walk the walk?
Right.
And it really is time to make a change here. And I know people are not, nobody I don't think is a one-issue voter, but if the situation revolving around veterans in this country has any meaning to you, it's a page worth looking at to find out who really does support veterans and who doesn't.
And it's emblematic of what's going on just right across the board.
It really is. It is simple as black and white, and it's a sad, ugly situation. You will find the Republicans on one side voting against funding. You will find Democrats on the other side voting for funding. And these are all nonpartisan statistics that people can look at.
Yeah, and it's all over at VAWatchdog.org. And I know you're not a spokesman for the Democratic Party. You're a spokesman for vets.
That's right, Tom. But we've got the information. Let them look at it.
Yeah, there you go. VAWatchdog.org. Larry Scott, the member of the DAV, the VFW, and WA1VET. Hey, not too bad. Not too shabby. 27 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Larry. We'll be back.
That's how it is. That's what we got. If the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Indeed, the fate of the American middle class. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. David in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, David, we were rudely interrupted by the realities of commercial radio a while ago, and you had a question about the Second Amendment.
I'm happy to be interrupted for Alex Jones anytime.
Yeah, he's a good guy. So yep. What's up?
Well, you had made a statement about the Second Amendment and what you believe the Founding Fathers' intent was several days ago. Do you remember him?
No, but I can tell you, you know, I've written about it. I've read the transcripts. I would refer you back actually to Pennsylvania actually had as an amendment to their constitution as a state back in the early days. I mean, they were one of the first 13 colonies. What was supposed to actually be the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And there's not much debate about it if you go back and read the history. Do you want me to restate that, or did you want to?
Well, you had said that it wasn't for it was for maintaining a militia, not in case we need to overthrow the government, etc.
Right.
And you also said that you know, who could stand up to the American military machine?
Right.
Well,
and
it looks like the people of Iraq are doing a pretty good job of that.
Yeah.
We are willing to carpet bomb and wipe out civilians en masse and not even being able to cover it up, we're not going to win any of these kinds of wars.
No, I agree with you. But the people of Iraq, there's all these stories that go into the memory hole, and there's one that I really wish I had hung on to. It's around here someplace in a box that's probably 4 feet square of, you know, because the stuff that we cover every day, you know, after we're done with it, we try and hang on to it. But it was a story that I saw once that flew through. It was an Associated Press story about how the Bush administration had been warned by, I believe it was Bremer's guys in the beginning, David Kaye's, you know, the first weapons inspectors, you know,
right,
who went in there and they were looking for weapons, and had been warned that they had identified some, I don't know, 40 or 50 sites around the country where there were these massive stockpiles of weapons that, you know, bombs and munitions and grenades and shoulder-fired rockets and all kinds of things that could be used in an insurgency to kill Americans.
Right.
And that step one should be to secure these 37 or 47 munitions dumps around the country, because they represented enough weaponry that if they were in the hands of an insurgency against the United States, they would be able to maintain a level of warfare that would be pretty much equal to what we could field with 135,000 soldiers for at least a decade.
Wow.
And the Bush administration, Rumsfeld, made the decision not to secure these weapons dumps. They were not secured. They were all basically looted. And that is what is fueling the insurgency. Now, this has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. You know, this has to do with what's going on in Iraq.
Right.
And that's a story that I think needs to be told more often. And maybe one of the folks in the chat room can track down the original story for me. They're really good at that. But with regard to the Second Amendment, there was Jefferson, when Madison... You'll find this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? When Madison sent the Constitution to Jefferson, Jefferson was the U.S. envoy to France. He was living in Paris at the time in 1787. And Madison was the kind of the godfather of the Constitution. He spent 5 years studying constitutions. He kept the notes of the Constitution. He wrote the first draft of the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention in what was then the Carpenters Union Hall in Philadelphia, what now is referred to as Constitution Hall or something like that. In any case, when Madison sent this to Jefferson, Jefferson read it and sent back a letter saying, you know, to his protege, James Madison was his, you know, his, well, protege, and said, you know, you did a great job here, and I like this, and I like this, and I like, you know, this division of power and the checks and balances and all this kind of stuff. I did a great job, but there's one thing that I do not like. What I do not like is that there is not a clear and unambiguous Bill of Rights attached to this Constitution, and that Bill of Rights must contain. And Jefferson outlined 10 things.
Right.
Those 10 things, 8 of those 10 things became the 10 Amendments. One of those 10 things that Jefferson said became the 5th, 6th, and 7th Amendments to the Constitution. You know, basically all the rights that you have if you're charged with a crime.
Right.
And because these guys, they were all Masons, and they thought that 10 was a mystical number, and they wanted it to be 10. So, you know, when they whittled it down to 8, they turned it back up into 10 by taking one of Jefferson's and breaking it into 3. But the 2 that Jefferson didn't get through, and again, you can also, if you go to TomHartmann.com and click on Articles on Democracy, I've written a couple of articles that have all these quotes from these passages of these dialogues between these two men. The other 2 were, 1, Jefferson wanted there to be a ban on commercial monopolies. He wanted, you know, the equivalent of the Sherman Antitrust Act, and he also thought patents and copyright shouldn't last more than 3 years. But he wanted an absolute ban on commercial monopolies. And Jefferson and Madison responded by saying, the word corporation doesn't even exist in the Constitution. That's all handled at the state level. And all the states have bans on commercial monopolies, so we don't have to do it federally. So Jefferson gave up on that. I mean, he fought for a little while, but then, you know, he said, okay, you're right. And then the other one was, Jefferson said, because armies during time of peace are instruments of mischief, that historically governments where there's some measure of democracy or some measure of republic, governments that have been overthrown have more often than not been overthrown by armies standing within them who have nothing better to do because it's a time of peace. We should make sure that when we're at peace, there is no standing army.
Right.
And
Thailand.
So, right. Just like Switzerland is. You know, this is how, you know, yeah, Thailand's a good example. In fact, I was there, you know, back, what, 12, 14 years ago, the last time they had a coup. No, it was 16, 18 years ago. In any case, yes. And so Jefferson's proposed that every man between the ages of 17 and 47 should, at the age of 17, be inducted in the military and be given basic military training and be given a weapon. And they keep that weapon in their home. And then but they're all civilians, and it's a civilian militia, and the militias are organized at the ward level and responsible to the county, and the county level responsible to the state, and can only be nationalized if the country's invaded or at war, if from the state level to the federal. And
like the revocation of habeas corpus, which they've done away with.
Well, that's you know, that's building the Constitution. That's going to get knocked down, assuming that we don't become a total Nazi state. But in any case, so Jefferson proposed this, and it got loudly debated, and they finally decided, you know, because we were still getting taking pot shots from the British up on the northern borders.
Right.
You know, we had the War of 1812 was just, you know, while Madison was president. I mean, it occurred right after Jefferson left the White House. And so what they decided was that they weren't going to write into the Constitution that we couldn't have a standing army. But in order to facilitate militias, in order to facilitate this, you know, should the United States become sufficiently stable that we could do what Jefferson was requesting, they wrote the Second Amendment, which reads, it's only one sentence, I'll read it, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. End of sentence. And it was not, none of them, I mean, it was never even brought up in the discussion that the people should have weapons so that they can overthrow the government. If they had meant that, they would have said the right of the people to replace their government shall not be infringed, and therefore their right to own weaponry, which includes state-of-the-art war weaponry like cannons and warships, shall not be infringed. It is absolutely not what they had in mind.
Right. And I think that gun issues have been one of the major things that they have divided the Democratic Party on.
I agree. And it's a tragedy. And I think the Democrats
are all liberals, but I talk about the Second Amendment, and they look at me like I'm some kind of alien. So
yeah, no, I think the Democratic Party really should learn a lesson from Bernie Sanders and from Brian Schweitzer in Montana, and say the gun issue is really two issues. There's the issue of whether or not you're going to have weapons of war as opposed to weapons of sport.
Right.
And weapons of war we're going to outlaw. Shoulder-fired missiles, 50-caliber machine guns, things like that. And they are outlawed. And with regard to weapons of sport, that is entirely an issue for states and localities. I mean, I cannot imagine why anybody could make an argument, or how anybody could make an argument, that you should be able to get a rifle permit to carry a hunting rifle in New York City. But I can easily imagine how living in Vermont or living in rural Oregon, gun laws should be very different. It should be relatively easy to get a weapon for sport or for hunting, if that's what you do.
Right.
And I think that, this is just common sense, and I think the Democratic Party needs to take that as a position. But see, the reality is that by and large, that is the Democratic Party's position. The Republicans have been just twisting and distorting it. So, anyhow, I don't want to turn this into a whole monologue on this, and we've got a bunch of callers, so I'm going to move along. But, David, thank you for the call.
Thank you, Tom. Remember the Eisenhower.
There you go. Yeah. We'll see what happens. We'll see if the Enterprise Battle Group starts leaving the area. Then we can all let our breath out. Eric in New York City. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Briefly, I had a question about one of your predictions, but I want to say it was the site was Al-Qaqa. I think it was a weapon site. I vaguely remember the story. The reporters were embedded with U.S. troops, and they got a tour of this place. And then I think later on, the reporters figured out during GPS.
Here it is.
Logs.
Yeah, David just handed it to me. Photo, video show Iraqi complex before, after invasion.
Right, they figured out with GPS logs that this is where they had been with the U.S. troops, and the place wasn't secure. I'll hold
300s. Well, yeah, okay, great, thank you. 360 tons of high-grade explosives cannot be accounted for, revising an earlier figure of 380 tons. This is October 10th, 2003. Yeah, 9 days after the fall of Baghdad, a news crew from Minneapolis saw this thing. Oh, man, it's incredible. 45 minutes past the hour. I'll give you all the details right after this, and we'll take some more calls. And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States. Hey, heads up, Friday, October 27th, this Friday, 7, that's day after tomorrow, isn't it? 7 to 9 p.m., the University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium. Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, Johnny Steele, and I, will be, is it and me or and I? Yeah, you take everybody else's out name out, and that's how you, we'll be debating Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys. Tickets are free, but you have to have them. And the place to get them is quakeradio.com, because it's co-sponsored by The Quake, KQKE, in San Francisco. And on an affiliate which carries this program, by the way. Of course. Therefore, I'm there. and we're grateful for it. Oh, my goodness. Okay, here's the story from Al-Qaqa, and then we'll go back to our caller. This is from CNN.com. David tracked this down for me while we were talking about it. 9 days after the fall of Baghdad, on April 18th, 2003, a news crew from Minneapolis station KSTP-TV, traveling with troops from the 101st Airborne Division, entered the bunkers at Al-Qaqa, south of Baghdad. At one of the bunkers, the troops broke a seal to get inside, where they found barrels filled with powdered explosives. David Kay says that this seal is consistent with that used by the IAEA. Turns out that they were under the seal of the UN. They were under the control of the UN. But we kicked the UN out just before we invaded. David Kay said that's either HMX or RDX, referring to the types of explosives. I don't know of anything else in Al-Qaqa that was in that form. The explosives, considered powerful enough to demolish buildings or detonate nuclear warheads, were reported missing from the Al-Qaqa depot in a letter this month from the interim Iraqi government to the U.N. Nuclear Watchdog Agency. The Iraqi letter to the IAEA, dated October 10, blamed the theft and looting of government installations on a, quote, this is the Iraqi government talking to the U.N., on a, quote, lack of security during the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, end quote. The agency now says more than 360 tons of high-grade explosives cannot be accounted for. Before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, the RDX and HMX stored in bunkers at Al-Qaqa were put under seal and monitored by IAEA inspectors. According to the Pentagon, inspectors last visited the complex on March 15, 2003, and they left the country 2 days later. On March 19th, the invasion began. And, of course, they left the country because George Bush told them they had to leave the country, although Bush, in hallucinating later, kind of changed the story a little.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
There's George Bush hallucinating again, but the reality is that the inspectors were there, that Saddam actually wanted them there. He saw them as the thing that prevented the U.S. from attacking him. Back to Eric in New York City. Hey, Eric.
Hi. I'll try to be brief. My other question was about your prediction. You were right about Death Squad John, of course. And now,
tragically,
sadly, of course,
For our listeners who don't know, when John Negroponte was sent to Iraq as the temporary ambassador, I pointed out that when he was sent down to Nicaragua, or Honduras rather, that within weeks, death squads showed up and bodies started appearing with their hands tied behind their backs and bullet holes in their heads. And I said, I hope the same thing doesn't happen in Iraq, but I fear it will. And sure enough, a week after John Negroponte went to Iraq, death squads appeared. And now John Negroponte's in charge of what?
Iraq. No,
he is in charge of the
NSA. Right.
He's in charge of the Department of Homeland Security. He's in charge of all security for the United States.
Why do you hate being right all the time?
Anyway.
It was about your prediction regarding, you said George Bush is going to declare victory and pull out. Now, I'm not doubting you, but I'm confused because, one, they're building the base you can see from space, but on the other hand, George Bush has no problems with timetables because he called for a timetable for withdrawal when we were in Bosnia.
Right. Yeah. Now he's gonna declare victory with regard to every place except these little islands that we own there.
Well, what about, like, is it just for electioneering? It looks like they're talking about pullout and then instead of timeline, or they're saying timetable. And I'll leave it at that. I'll let you clear up my confusion.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks,
yeah.
Tom. Thanks, Tom, for a great job you do too.
You're welcome. Thank you, Eric. No, it's, you know, what Bush is doing right now is he's trying to say in code to people who are concerned about Iraq, hey, I get it. I get it. This isn't working. We are going to change course. We are going to fix things. I just can't quite say it because it would be politically unfeasible. What's the word? Infeasible, whatever. But yeah, we're really not about changing, stay the course. We're about adapt or win. At the same time, he's saying to the Hawks, we're going to kick their butts. Don't worry. This is what's going to be happening. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Al-Qaqa name is just too convenient for puns.
I know. So let's not go there.
Anyway, speaking of Alex Jones, some of the people who he's worked with before are having a big event here in Denver this week. The 9/11 Scholars for Truth with Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, and Kevin Barrett are going to be here in Denver and Boulder on the weekend.
Hmm. Is there a website for more information?
Yeah, you go to Colorado911visibility.org.
Okay. Great.
And so they're just a much mellower version than what Alec is speaking.
Alex on Valium, is that it?
Yeah, so these are pretty renowned scholars, such as Stephen Jones, who is a physicist who disproved the cold fusion thing a few years ago and such.
Right, yeah.
And they've got very reasoned arguments. So anybody who's, especially those who don't have any doubt about 9/11, it would be very worthwhile for them to come. So again, Colorado 911visibility.org.
Great. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Always great to hear from you. We're going to wrap up the show here. Tomorrow, John Murtha is coming saying, those guys in the White House, the Republican buddies in Congress, are telling me to sit down and shut up and stay the course. I'm not going to. And we'll have a debate with conservative Myron Abell. That and more in your calls tomorrow on the Tom Hartman radio program, The Democracy Zone. And remember, my friends,
Activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. It all starts when each one of us gets involved. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.